Not only does the deal fail to halt Iran's nuclear ambitions, but it also fails to address the regime's development of ballistic missiles.
Trump pulls out of Iran nuclear deal with implications for North Korea. It's Wednesday, May 9th. This is VOA Asia. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Hello and welcome. Join us as well on Facebook at VOA Asia. Also ahead, China upset with airline country designations. Feeding India's hungry. Detecting peanut allergies. A new space commander. And more, all on today's VOA Asia. President Donald Trump on Tuesday pulled the United States out of the 2015 international agreement aimed at restraining Iran's nuclear program, contending that it is a disastrous pact.
Not only does the deal fail to halt Iran's nuclear ambitions, but it also fails to address the regime's development of ballistic missiles that could deliver nuclear warheads.
The U.S. leader said he is reimposing the highest levels of economic sanctions on Iran. Trump said he was open to working with its European allies to negotiate a new deal with the Islamic Republic to curb its ballistic missile tests and military advances in Syria, Yemen, and elsewhere in the Mideast, although Tehran has already declared it is not interested in forging a new accord. In abrogating the deal, Trump lived up to campaign vows he made in his 2016 run to the White House, but in doing so, he also rejected pleas from three of the U.S.'s closest allies, Britain, France, and Germany, to stay in the deal, which also included China and Russia. The International Atomic Energy Agency has certified 10 times that Iran is complying with the deal. The three-year-old agreement called for lifting sanctions on Iran that had hobbled its economy in exchange for Iran restraining its nuclear program, which Iran has claimed was for peaceful purposes. The move has implications with the planned summit in perhaps a few weeks between President Trump and North Korean leader Kim Jong-un. The White House says President Trump and Chinese President Xi Jinping spoke by telephone Tuesday and agreed that sanctions against North Korea should remain in place until it, quote, permanently dismantles its nuclear and missile programs.
Secretary Pompeo is on his way to North Korea in preparation for my upcoming meeting with Kim Jong-un. Plans are being made, relationships are building. Hopefully, a deal will happen, and with the help of China, South Korea, and Japan, a future of great prosperity and security can be achieved for everyone.
VOA Asia's Ira Melman spoke with Clayton Duby, who heads the USC-US-China Institute at the University of Southern California, about the situation.
What happens with the discussions with Pompeo, of course, will be, you know, very important, and President Trump seeks and likes drama. And so whether or not they, you know, release the Korean-American prisoners, whether or not they, you know, subsequently do announce when this meeting is to happen and where it's to happen and all of those sorts of things remains to be seen. But the question is, from my perspective, is are they trying to hammer out some sort of joint communique? It seems unlikely that in a short series of meetings, and that's all they've had so far, and that's all that they are planned to have, that it would be very difficult to work out with the sort of detail that would be required a real time, a plan for denuclearization and a timeline with all the verification steps and things like that.
One wonders now, and I realize this is speculation on all part because there's no answer yet, if this would have any effect on the stance of the North Koreans or anyone else in these upcoming negotiations with South Korea and the United States.
Well, smart negotiators on the North Korean side are sure to raise this as an issue. They will say, well, why should we trust the United States if it's so willing, so soon after agreeing as part of this collective agreement with Iran to end Iran's nuclear weapons development program, why North Korea should trust American determination to stay the course and to adhere to any terms of the agreement? At the same time, my own feeling is that North Korea doesn't have high expectations for these negotiations. They are making a lot of sending a lot of signs, but they don't necessarily expect to get everything that they may be seeking. Just the fact that the meeting is happening already changes the context in which the region exists. It changes the relationship that North Korea has with Japan, that North Korea has with South Korea, and that North Korea has with China. And so just the fact that Kim Jong-un is expected to meet with the American president after years and years of American president saying we have nothing to talk about is quite a victory for him.
For the second time in a few months, Kim Jong-un traveled to China to meet with Xi Jinping. Number one, did that surprise you? And what do you think Kim Jong-un wanted to accomplish, if indeed he was the impetus to the meeting, or do you think it might have been Xi Jinping?
I don't know who initiated the meeting, and it's possible that over time we will know that answer. I'm sure that Kim Jong-un wanted to signal to China that he was not acting against China's interests. He wanted to signal that he would maintain open communication with Beijing and that China's concerns did matter to him. He is trying to manage his situation with South Korea, with China, and with the United States.
Dr. Clayton Dubey, the director of the U.S.-China Institute at the University of Southern California. These are among some of the top Asia stories currently trending on VOANews.com. Trump and Xi agree North Korean sanctions should remain in place for now. U.S. and China to meet for round two of trade talks, but big differences remain. Mystery surrounds landing of North Korean airliner in China. UN Food Agency aims to boost aid to North Korea, but lacks funds. It's back to school for some of Thailand's elderly. Expanded coverage of these stories and much more are on Facebook at VOA Asia. Also, stop by our VOANews.com website. VOA Asia continues. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. China has dismissed U.S. criticism of its demands that 36 foreign airlines, including American companies, refrain from references that suggest Taiwan, Hong Kong, and Macau are independent of Beijing. The Chinese Civil Aviation Administration sent notice to the carriers April 25th. The White House denounced what it called China's Orwellian nonsense, a reference to English novelist George Orwell and his vision of a future totalitarian state in the book 1984. The White House called it part of a growing trend to impose its political views on American citizens and private companies and called for a halt to its threats and coercion. Jeffrey Thomas, editor of the Australia-based AirlineRatings.com website, tells VOA's Victor Beatty this is a political minefield, describing the U.S. reaction as sharp.
The response from other parts of the world has been less so. Apparently, 36 airlines are involved in the letter from the Chinese authorities about the way they address Taiwan, Hong Kong, and Macau. Now, the interesting part about this is, for the most part, from what we can assess, most airlines refer correctly to Hong Kong and Macau as they have Hong Kong in brackets SAR, which is Special Administrative Region, which is exactly what they are as part of China. They don't suggest that they are independent countries because they are simply not. They're part of China and they have a special economic zone situation and they're relatively autonomous, but the reality is they're not. As far as the airlines are concerned, they refer to them correctly. Taiwan, of course, is a very different situation and far more complicated, and I'm not sure how airlines will get around this issue. But at the same time, one may think that this particular spat is related to the wider trade negotiations between the United States and China, with the China's massive trade surplus and deficit for the United States. That's the bigger picture. One can't but help think that this is all part of the tit-for-tat or the pre-negotiation type strategies that are going on.
Jeffrey, a spokesman for Airlines for America, a trade group representing United, American, and other major U.S. carriers, said Saturday it's working with the U.S. government to determine next steps in the dispute. What might those steps be?
Well, the next steps really is all about how do we address the Chinese concerns. And I mean, a lot of this is very, very fine cultural sensitivity. And for instance, just to give you an example here, the National Airline of Taiwan is China Airline. The two countries are known as China, the People's Republic of China, and Taiwan, Republic of China. They both speak Mandarin. They have history going back hundreds and hundreds of years. So there's all sorts of issues here. And it maybe is something as simple. For instance, Taipei, which is the airport that all these airlines fly to, the IATA code for Taipei is TPE for Taipei. Now, it may well be that they change it to TSAR, which is Taipei Special Economic Region. It could be something as simple as changing a code of where these airlines fly to on the website that placates the whole situation. It may sound silly to listeners that might be all that's required, but quite often that is all that's required in some of these ultra-sensitive cultural issues related to China.
The U.S. State Department said Secretary of State Mike Pompeo and Chinese Politburo member Yang Jiechi, in a phone call, affirmed the importance of a constructive, results-oriented bilateral relationship. Happening now in Asia, trade negotiations between China and the United States continue early next week in Washington. But analysts say after the first round, the differences between the two sides are huge. Some believe the differences are so fundamental and big that an escalation of tariffs is unavoidable. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. We hope your day is going well, and we're glad you're with us on VOA Asia. India's battle with hunger has been a long one. According to a UN report, over 190 million Indians go hungry every day. This, while tons of food go to waste in hotels, restaurants, and wedding dinners. A volunteer organization called the Robin Hood Army is trying to bridge the gap between leftover food and those who need it, not just in India, but in 12 other nations. Rital Joshi caught up with the Robin Hood Army in New Delhi.
Juhi Shahi is a dedicated soldier in the Robin Hood Army, which has but one enemy, hunger. Its ammunition is food, and the volunteers like Renu Vij, who prepare it regularly.
If I go on my own, then the quantity that I am cooking, I will not be able to meet the demands of any group. If I go to an orphanage or a shelter, the number will be more. Here, if many people are pooling in, the food resource becomes more.
It's a long and arduous battle against hunger. But these soldiers never balk under pressure.
Restaurants, weddings, parties, say.
We collect leftover food from restaurants, weddings, parties, and distribute it to poor. Sometimes restaurants also cook fresh food for us. We are in India, Pakistan, Sri Lanka, Canada, Philippines, Malaysia.
Robin Hood Army carries out organized drives every Sunday. Many restaurants prepare food specially for these drives. As soon as the volunteers receive a call from the restaurant, food collection begins. As the number of volunteers increases, food packets also start mounting. The volunteers then set out for the most heartwarming part of the drive, passing out the food.
Every Sunday there are some kids who wait for you to bring food to them. They also start making demands like, please get burgers next time.
Volunteers in the Robin Hood Army are mostly working professionals or students. Launched 4 years ago in Delhi, the organization now has chapters in 60 cities across the world. Ground rules for all chapters are the same. Donations in cash are strictly prohibited, but food packets are always welcome. Volunteers are encouraged to spend time with the beneficiaries.
every Sunday, mera ye ki ek,
malab, this has become a part of my schedule every Sunday that I am with them from 5 to 7. Parties, social gatherings, or meetings with friends are all done post 7 p.m.
Apart from these organized drives, Robin Hood Army gets calls from various hotels and restaurants throughout the week to come collect their leftover food. Many times, volunteers end up distributing food well past midnight. They say the happy faces they leave behind make the effort worthwhile. Ritul Joshi for VOA News, New Delhi.
Coming up, real versus fake in the Australian art world. You're listening to VOA Asia.
From Pink to Pitbull, Beyonce to Bruno Mars, the hits live here on the Top 20 Countdown. Hi, I'm Ray McDonald, and for the past 30 years, I've been counting down the very best of the Billboard Hot 100 Pop Singles Chart. The hit list never sleeps, so don't you miss a moment of the action. Join me every Thursday for the Top 20 Countdown, right here and worldwide on the Voice of America.
This news from VOA Asia, the United Nations Food Agency chief is making a 4-day visit to North Korea to look into boosting food distributions to hungry women and children in the latest sign of an opening in the isolated country. The World Food Program said it had been active in the North for years. The visit will focus on increased support. We support your diet for news each day at VOA Asia Facebook. This is VOA Asia. As VOA Asia continues, a parliamentary inquiry in Australia is investigating fake Aboriginal art and craft. The committee has heard from campaigners in Western Australia that up to 90% of Indigenous art sold in souvenir shops was fake and imported from overseas. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
Indigenous artists say that current laws protecting Aboriginal art in Australia are inadequate and that fines should be imposed on people selling fake art. Campaigners in Western Australia estimate that the vast majority of the pieces sold in the state souvenir stores were bogus and shipped in from overseas. They're calling for better education to help the buying public be more aware of the sensitivities surrounding fakes. Some of the copies are mass-produced in Indonesia and shipped for sale, mostly to foreign tourists in Australia. Other pieces are made in China. Some Aboriginal artists in Australia license their work to be legitimately reproduced overseas, giving them a percentage of sales. Gabrielle Sullivan from the Indigenous Art Code, which works to protect the rights of artists, says licensing can be a way to make money, but it's important the artist understands the whole process.
That can be done fairly ethically. And, you know, the artist can be part of that process. The artist can get promotion from that. They can be attributed. But that means the artist has to be, you know, taken along for the ride and understand the whole supply chain of how that product comes into being.
The trade in imitations not only takes income away from those artists producing authentic items. Aboriginal groups insist that passing off paintings as Indigenous is disrespectful to their ancient culture. Tribal art is focused on folklore and used to chronicle Indigenous beliefs, including the sanctity of the earth and stories of creation. The fake art and craft trade isn't against the law in Australia, unless imported souvenirs falsely claim to be authentic. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
This news from VOA Asia, the White House says President Donald Trump and Chinese President Xi Jinping agreed Tuesday that sanctions against North Korea should remain in place until it permanently dismantles its nuclear and missile programs. The two leaders spoke by telephone after a 2-day meeting between Xi and North Korean leader Kim Jong-un. More on VOA Asia Facebook. This is VOA Asia. Now on VOA Asia, peanuts are the most common cause of fatal food-induced severe allergic reactions. But British scientists have found a better way to monitor a significant food hazard by developing a more accurate blood test. And it's 5 times cheaper than the existing one. VOA's Mariama Diallo reports.
The new diagnosis has a nearly 100% accuracy rate, say researchers from Britain's Medical Research Council.
If we test random children in the general population, about 1 in 5 with a positive test would actually be allergic if we challenge them. In this test, 98% of children with a positive test would be allergic. So this is how much more specific it is.
Current tests are based on looking for antibodies and cannot tell the difference between a food sensitivity and an actual allergy. Sometimes follow-ups are needed. Alexandra Santos says patients are usually given incremental doses of the suspect food while doctors observe their conditions, and that can be stressful.
There were a couple of patients that unexpectedly reacted with quite severe reactions, which is what can happen.
This is what pushed the pediatric allergist to rethink the process.
Show me that we really need to find better ways. We need to find better tests to diagnose food allergies. They show a certain marker.
Her method uses so-called mast cells, which play a big role in triggering allergic symptoms such as skin reactions or airway constriction.
I'm really hoping that it will be useful for other food allergies as well, because it can really help patients.
Research has found that among children with food allergies, peanut is the most prevalent allergen, followed by milk and then shellfish. Mariama Diallo, VOA News.
On June 6th, a few months short of its 20th birthday, the International Space Station, or ISS, is scheduled to receive its newest crew, including the new commander, German astronaut Alexander Gerst. While Gerst and other members of his team are undergoing rigorous training in NASA's Johnson Space Center in Houston, VOA's George Pudich tells us Airbus engineers are preparing the first personal assistant to fly to space.
Standing on a special platform, encapsulated in their heavy spacesuits, Alexander Gerst and his crewmate, NASA astronaut Serena Onnen-Chancellor, slowly sink into a 12-meter-deep pool with a life-size replica of the International Space Station. Assisted by instructors in diving suits, astronauts train for 6 hours a day for all kinds of situations they may encounter during their spacewalks. Gerst, who flew to the ISS in 2014, says doing it the second time is a bit easier.
The first time you fly, you have the problem that you get a lot of detail. People tell you a lot of things that you can never remember all.
Astronauts also train inside the replica station, especially for emergency situations, because 400 kilometers above the Earth, there's no point in calling an emergency number. As astronauts train, instructors follow and evaluate every move. Other training involves science experiments that can be done only in space. For instance, tests with cancer cells.
In weightlessness, we can suspend them in the fluid, and we actually found that they behave differently up there, but more close to how they behave in the human body.
The fresh crew will also bring the first of its kind mobile assistant, called Simon, built by the Airbus Corporation.
It's meant to be a social, interactive, free-flying object who shall assist the crew during extensive tasks and to reduce stress.
Equipped with artificial intelligence, this 32-centimeter wide ball with a screen displaying a simple face also has its own propulsion. Simon will help astronauts solve various problems and provide entertainment.
Great. Let's play your favorite hits.
Scientists also want to see if artificial intelligence could serve as a mediator during long, deep space flights.
To have something like Simon on board, it is meant to help during this specific situation to react with a good countermeasure, to solve the situation in a group, and to lead to mission success.
Alexander Gerst says he cannot wait to sit again by the ISS window and look at our planet. George Pudich, VOA News.
You've been listening to VOA Asia. You'll find us online at iTunes and SoundCloud. You can also hear us on the radio. If you happen to be out and about somewhere in the Asia region, you can hear us like in Thailand, Chiang Mai University, Radio FM 100, Chiang Mai University. Thanks to everyone there who tuned in today and wherever you happen to be hearing our program. We thank our director, Tracy Carter, engineer Rob McLean, managing editor Diane Gao, Skylar Ogden, David Byrd, and Ira Melman on our VOA Asia team. I'm Jim Stevenson. We're in Washington. We hope you have a nice day ahead.